Thank you for coming in such large number, and sorry for the mess up with the room at the beginning. As we have already established, this is FM Soft. The name is misleadingly German, but the lecture will be given in English, especially that I received some requests from Erasmus students anyways. Yeah, right. Right. Well, of course, you can communicate in German, especially with Christoph, who is native speaker and who will be in charge of tutorials, and even with me occasionally if you really need to. But all the materials are prepared in English. I'm sorry for this. So, lecture slot is, as you know already quite well, right. And the room is, of course, obsolete. From next week on, we'll probably not need slides. So even if the projection issue is not solved, we can stick to the other room. But if we stick with this number of participants, actually, maybe a good idea to switch to this room anyway. The other room is too small. And exercise with Christoph will be on Friday tutorials. Normally, of course, one avoids having tutorials in the first week, but we were thinking it may be a good idea to have something this week as well, because there is a lot of installation that you have to do. In particular, right now you will need to use new SMB, new XMV tool, and three other tools. I will come to them in due time in those slides. And it is huge waste of time to have to spend each time when we move from one tool to another, one whole tutorial in making sure that it's running, especially if we have so many people, that it's running on everybody's computer. So we can discuss this later, but I think it may make sense to have special tutorial session with no real proper exercises, just making sure that everybody can install what we need for this particular lecture. Well, of course, this is completely out of question. With the number of people that I'm seeing here, I had some requests for change of time and date, but if most people here can attend and at this lecture slot when there is more than five people, it is just not possible to switch switch lectures. Well, I already started talking about tutorials. Christoph will deal with this in due time. You will need to bring your own laptops. I mean, the software is available generally in CPool, but I'm not sure how wise police it is to rely on it. We need to make sure that I will only mention the names of all the tools later on, but at least by next week everybody should have new SMV, new XMV up and running for the tutorials. So shall we then have this tutorial session this week? Just installation session.
So if not everybody brings a laptop, it's fine too, because judging from the numbers, there will be group exercises anyway. So if in a group of four, there's one
Mm-hmm. Group exercise meaning that you don't submit individual solutions of House of Gabe, but a team of three or four people is submitting it, just like with other courses like Gloin. And actually, how about recording them? Is it? I guess that the idea is that both slots are recorded, right? So when the House of Gabe are being solved, probably we will simply ask you, as usual, to switch the recording off, as it happens in most lectures. But and I'm not sure if there is so much to record if you're just installing the tool. But you know, we can prepare a video tutorial step by step how to go through it. Okay, grading and final mark, as you have already seen, I guess, in the Univis, it's 50-50. And especially in this lecture, a lot comes, I think even tutorials are more of attraction of this lecture than the lecture itself, because this is where you get to play with the toys, actually. And the half of the mark comes from the 30 minutes of final exam. And I'm not getting in the way, or kind of, yeah. You need to have passing grade from both. So again, this is standard setup, I guess. But if you didn't have even, I don't know, 40 or 30% of House of Gabe mark, then it doesn't make sense to take the oral exam. So, and it will be hard to make up for it if you start working on House of Gabe only in December. So really, please take those tutorials seriously. For the lecture materials, this is going to be self-contained. You need to attend the lectures and take notes. There will be occasional situations like today where I actually give slides, and then I will make these slides available, encoded by password probably to keep with the copyright and intellectual property issues. I'm not sure how useful those slides are, but this is mostly a cell talk anyway. This is why it was easier to have slides rather than Blackboard presentation, but from next week on, almost everything will be happening on the Blackboard anyway. And as you have already seen, we are being recorded, but the fact that something was not recorded, or that recording was not online by the time of the next lecture, it's not an excuse at all for tutorials, for exams and whatever. This is something that you can use, but this is not an official prop. I hope this is clear. I will use additional literature, and I may give you additional references. It is not something that you have to look at. It is something that you can look at if you feel like, or if you feel that the material of the lecture is in the lecture is insufficient. Well, maybe then let's not even tempt you to read too much for the time being. Let's skip this. Are there any organizational questions apart from it? Yeah.
Yes. Is it necessary to register for the lecture?
For us, not at all. I mean, I don't. It's only between you and proofing summit. I don't care.
I ask because it's different from lecture to lecture.
I understand. But this is elective lecture, and we absolutely careless about it in the whole chair. So, if you just want to sit in the lecture and attend it, you are more than welcome. If you want to take the exam, this another question that I often get is when the exam happens, whenever you want. I mean, as long as there is enough, like two or three people, as long as Christoph and myself are there to, so that there is a lecture and by Sitzer, we can arrange it anytime. We can arrange it in January, we can arrange it in late March, beginning of April. At some point, there is, from proofing some point of view, there is a bit of a problem because the lecture window is, the exam window is closing, I think, so 7th or 15th of April, it varies from year to year. And then we need to let proofing some know if there is somebody still left who wants to take the lecture. If you want, of course, to get the grade in register by proofing some, that there is still somebody left to be examined in April, let's say. So this is the only limitation. But as long as it stays within reasonable limit, January, February, March, we will arrange it probably by Doodle. Hopefully, most of you will survive. So there will be quite a few slots to arrange. Yeah. So, apart from this, another question, or everything is clear so far? Okay, so we can go to the sales talk. And these days, almost everybody can write some code, but it's much harder to design, write, and maintain good code, and even still harder, code which is absolutely reliable. First of all, you need to have good specification, and you also need to know that the code conforms to those specifications. And we all know that it may or may not happen that software contains bugs, and some of them are worse than others. Like an example in this little story.
Final decision, the girl was taken. Bricolage. 37 seconds into the launch, the onboard computers decided Fiber 1 was 90 degrees off course. They made an automatic adjustment to the trajectory as the rocket was traveling at the speed of sound.
So, everybody knows what it was, right? Ariane 5. Who knows what happened? So this is the most concise description in a popular reference I was able to find. As you see, it was a very trivial overflow issue. 64 floating point data converted into 16-bit signed integer value. And this triggered overflow in the software, and the handler which could handle it was disabled. So once this happened, you got the error cascading through the whole system, which, as you have heard in the video, convinced onboard computers that it's dangerously the whole rocket is dangerously wheeling 90 degrees of the course, where, as you see, as you saw physically in this video, nothing like this was happening. It was perfectly on course and on target, but the inbuilt apparatus had to distract it in order to avoid terrible crash if the computers are getting the message that it's 90 degrees of course. Fortunately, in this case, in as much as I know at least, there was no loss of life. This was just a terribly expensive satellite, which was a very prestigious project for French and for the whole ESA, European Space Agency, and European Union. Still, imagine what it entailed politically and economically. And probably you have, each of you have heard about his or her own favorite spectacular bug that happened. I'm putting some links in this lecture that you can easily click upon if you're interested, including the description of the Ariane 5 disaster that that I put on the previous slide. Here are some of the bugs from the first link that you saw on the previous slide. And as you see, it involves absolutely safety critical situations, including Mars climate orbiter, airplanes, both civilian and military ones. Perhaps most tragically and most depressingly, healthcare tragedies. Probably you have heard, for example, about Terak disaster. So this is, and as just like in case of Ariane 5, it is not that each and every of this catastrophe was caused by error impossible to foresee, no matter how much analysis of the code you would do beforehand. Of course, these are the large, spectacular dramas, and on a small scale, this is happening every day, which each of us, definitely including myself. So every day we discover bugs, errors, oversights, glitches, vulnerabilities, and so on and so on. If you're very unlucky, you will end up on a list like the one of Dershowitz, one causing millions of dollars of damage, hopefully just material damage and not endangering human life or health. But even if not, even if you're not if you do not happen to develop a safety critical systems, even if you don't waste millions of man hours, because this is what realistically goes into developing Mars orbiter or a space shuttle or anything like this, but rather hundreds of man hours in a small family or middle-sized software company rather than something with national security clearance. This is not as scary, but still it's hard to see this as positive development. Let's agree on this. And this point was very forcefully made by one of the pioneers of computer science, Edgar Dijkstra, when he was receiving his Turing lecture, Turing Award, sorry. You know what Turing Award is, right? A kind of Nobel Prize in computer science. He said that as long as there were no machines, programming was no problem at all. When you had a few weak computers, programming became a mild problem. And now that we have gigantic computers, programming had become equally gigantic problem. So in the sense, we didn't solve a single problem, we created a problem of using its products. Of course, the last part is a bit of exaggeration. Dijkstra was known to be both arrogant and prone to provocation, but and we know that software did solve lots of problems too. But it's not that what he's saying is completely pointless. And just to realize how pervasive those problems are, yet another example that you can easily find online, which made a huge splash 10 years ago. It was discovered, originally made by on the blogs by one of the main people behind Java development kit, that nearly all binary searchers and merge sorts are broken. Apparently, this issue was lying in wait when they were developing JDK for like 9 years or so before it broke somebody's code, but then imagine that you are relying on standard libraries like this when developing a larger software system or something like the Ariane project. Who sees where the problem is? Which line? Where can it go wrong? Yes? Exactly. That's precisely it. So of course, if you had some error handling, you should take care of this, but there is nothing of this kind indicated here. It may very well happen that what you add will end up with being greater than 2 to the power of 31 minus 1. And this will overflow to negative value. And the value stays negative when divided by 2. And depending on the programming language, of course, this has very different consequences. In case of C, you get array index out of bounds with unpredictable results. In Java, you get array index out of bound exception, which is also quite unpredictable error with this particular piece of software. Let's agree. There are at least there are more than 2 or 3 papers on the subject, but some of those that are obvious references. And I think that the next one, this one is even used at some point in the tutorial, Framia-C part of the tutorials. Well, maybe this, maybe it is not. But it was inspiration even for research level paper, including one of the formalism like separation logic that we want to speak more about in the later part of this lecture. So if, assuming it is possible to avoid this kind of problems, how could this be done? Well, of course, you would say testing. And this is not an incorrect answer in a way, because you do need to test. I mean, there is no, it would be extremely irresponsible of me or anybody else to try to convince you that testing is obsolete and you should not touch it anymore, quite to the contrary. But let's not cheat ourselves. People, you saw what kind of problems people run into in safety critical system, and let's not insult their intelligence, and let's not assume that they didn't have done any testing when developing projects which were involving control of the transport system for an entire city, or radiation for cancer treatment, or space shuttles, or orbiters, or system, or a phone system of AT&T, because this is the kind of problems that we were seeing. But from purely logical, or even shall we say philosophical, point of view, if you made 1 million or whatever, 10 million or 100 million, 41 successful tests, why it would be a logical guarantee that 1 million, or 10 million, or 100 million, 42 tests will not blow something up? Of course, probability gets lower and lower. And if you talk to people who are in engineering, there is, which with any large project, you always say how many numbers after digits of, so whether you want to have just 99.9%. Of certainty, or 99.99999% of conviction that nothing will go wrong, and going each order of magnitude also involves going exponentially with costs of testing involved. But again, coming back to that lecture of Edgar Dijkstra, this during our lecture, program testing can be very effective way to show the presence of bugs, but it's hopelessly inadequate to showing, for showing their absence. And I don't think I need to argue that this is exactly like it is from logical point of view. This is something that philosophers were actually talking about for centuries. The most famous one of them, David Hume, made a case that, or famously illustrated this by saying that the fact that sun has gone up from the beginning of the world until today, every day in the morning, is no guarantee that the sun will rise tomorrow, from a logical point of view. So putting aside jokes about death and taxes, we can only reason with certainty about mathematical objects. And the point is that programs are not just, let's say, flashing symbols on screens. They are indeed mathematical entities, and if we do things correctly, we should be reason about them with in as much certainty as mathematical modeling allows us to. And one of the books that we will use in the later part of this lecture, where we actually start to talk about programming language semantics, is saying that very thing in just right in the introduction. In giving a formal semantics to a programming language, we are concerned with building a mathematical model, and its purpose is to serve as a basis for understanding and reasoning how programs behave. And mathematical models are useful not only for various kinds of analysis and verification, although this is what is most important for us here, but also at more fundamental level, because the activity of trying to define meaning of program constructions can reveal all kinds of subtleties that you should be aware of. So now we can, with these general guidelines in mind, we can say a bit more what is going to happen in this lecture. In the first part, we will talk about model checking and temporal logic. And tutorials will focus on, as I said, on the new SMB, new XMB tool. And probably the way we are going to do it is that following the lecture, as soon as we stop doing model checking, we will move to part two that I'm going to discuss in the second. And then later on, at the very end, we will add the most flashy part, I think, or the newest attraction that we are going to offer in tutorials for this year. Returning to model checking, we are going to talk about SCADE tool, which is industrial strength, which with extremely expensive license. I will not detail why we ended up having a license for this in the chair, but if we have it, it would be a sin not to play around with it a bit more. But we cannot spend all our time just on model checking. If we are going to give you a reasonable overview of the whole variety of possible approaches to formal verification. And in the part two of the lectures, at least of the lectures on the blackboard, as you see, the structure of tutorials will be a bit more zigzagging probably, will be devoted to, but both part one and part two, of course, of the lectures will be reflected in tutorials in the way described here. We will talk about semantics of programming languages. Some of this stuff, actually, how many people here I remember from Semprog already, like HorLogic, we have already done there. But I will try to spend a bit more time than I spend in Semprog so far. Maybe this year also in Semprog, I'm going also to go more in that direction. Try to discuss some of the HOR rules for HOR languages for reasoning about programs involving heaps, pointers, and mutable data structures, rather than just basic toy language, imperative toy language, IMP. But of course, in the lecture, you don't want to have too many nice things in the language, because this means that all the theorems that you have to prove will be much more complicated, and you will have to give much more complicated semantics on blackboard, which is probably something that you don't desire, pen and paper. Instead, you will get to play with more or less industrial strength, both research level and industrial level tools for annotating programming, real-life programming languages. Let's not discuss how real-life programs themselves will be, using FRAMAC, and which is mostly focusing on standard imperative paradigm, and very fast tool when we want to focus more specifically on pointers, heaps, and mutable data structures. In the past, we used to do a bit, actually we spent most of the tutorials on a toy programming language with hardwired HOR reasoning or features or HOR annotation, part of syntax where verification and compilation were tangled inseparably, namely Daphne, but I'm not really convinced that this is the right tool to teach. I think that the right approach is what we're doing since last year, namely to teach tools which allows you to annotate real-life programming languages like C with annotation in some special annotation standard language like ADSL and work with that. So this is a general overview. I know. I understand that this is still quite confusing, but if you want contents of both lectures and tutorials and between them on one slide, or at least a set of slogans or keywords, this is what we are going to do here. Are there any questions regarding this already, or you give yourself time to hear more? If not, maybe let's progress for the time being. One point that I'd like to that probably should be made clear is that tutorial part requires on fully automated tools. So what is happening is that one writes probably ideally first pen and paper and only then using keyboard a detailed specification of the desired outcome using assertions, pre and post conditions, invariants, and so on. Then you press enter or write something in the command line, then you start to wait, then you wait longer, then you wait still longer, and then computer either answers I could verify or I couldn't. And this is no exaggeration, it really takes time. As you will see, even getting to the stage where you verify algorithms from hardly exceeding basic algorithm cores like binary search or whatever, and throwing all the annotations, assertions that computer needs to fully automatically verify that it holds, it takes several weeks actually. And there is always a bit of trade-off, at least in tutorials, whether one wants to go deeply with one tool or just give you a leak, like 2 or 3 weeks of each of them, and then move to another one. So, because this semester we want to try 4 different tools, each of them serious enough and usable, genuinely usable, actually, all of them. None of them is just purely academic toy, I would say. And some of them I use, as you will hear in much more detail, especially from Christoph, in genuinely serious industrial context. Well, we can only let you, as you say in Polish, leak lollipop through a window glass, but maybe it's still better than nothing. And yeah, so sorry, I was running ahead of my own slides. Finding which information to give and what the tool of in question is far from trivial. But only some of these things, some of the problems have to do with our own stupidity or too simple level that we can go into in this introductory lecture, a limitation of our machines, and so on and so on. There are some deep theoretical reasons why this kind of fully automated, fully automated approaches can only go so far. And it's actually amazing that they can be made as powerful as they are now, and hopefully they will be still made more powerful in the future. But still, it's a valid question if one can find alternative approaches to this fully automated verification. Well, of course we can, and one of them is actually what we are going to do in the lecture part from next week, prove everything by hand. So, feasibility, of course, depends on complexity of computation involves, but and sometimes, of course, when you're verifying something which has little, let's say, theoretical depth, but lots of trivial cases to check, it's not something that you ever want to do by hand. But on the other hand, sometimes when the issue is rather finding a non-trivial reasoning step, it's nowhere as insane as it may seem. And again, coming back to the example of Dijkstra that keeps reappearing in these introductory lectures, this is how he spent his whole life. He was only verifying programs using his fountain pen. He only got a MacBook at the towards the end of his life, and it was only for the purpose of checking his email, basically, and browsing the web. He never used it for actual program verification. So given that he got a kind of Nobel Prize in computer science, as you see, you can get quite far. And it's perhaps not a coincidence that he also said that computer science is not more about computers than astronomy is about telescopes. As I said, if you see program as a mathematical object, it's pretty natural thing to say. The third remaining option is somewhere, we can say, in between. This is something what is happening when you actually work with proof assistants, where you guide the tool through the verification process, and you can incorporate fully automated components, but you don't rely solely on them. And as some of you already know, actually this approach is behind some of the most impressive achievements of program verification these days. But this is not covered in this lecture. This is something that we do in SEMPROC, in Praktische Semantik Word Programming Sprachen, that I'm doing always in spring. So you are always invited there. So, in general, formal verification techniques can be thought of as comprising of 3 parts. One of them is framework for modeling system, which is typically a description language of some sort. Another is a specification language for describing the properties to be verified. And then verification methods, which can be some kind of algorithm, to establish whether the description of the system satisfies the specification. Maybe actually I should keep it longer a bit because some people are making notes, right? Is it okay? Because you started noting?
It's all right.
Okay. And in model checking, when we talk about model checking, we are talking about automatic, model-based property verification approach, which is intended to be used for concurrent reactive systems. Originally, it was designed to be used post-development, so after you design something, but these days it's not restricted to post-development tools. And the specification language we are going to talk about will be various flavors of temporal or modal logic. And this is what's going to begin from next week on. Actually, who here has seen some modal logic of any kind? That's not bad, but still I'm then not assuming any familiarity with it. So some of you will just get an unfair advantage, but it's better than people having to catch up with. Right, and actually I think this is enough for the introductory lecture. Are there any questions? So, I mean, the only thing I could do is to start talking about, to switch off the slides and start talking about temporal and modal logic, which actually, you know, maybe 40 minutes. It actually went much quicker than I expected. So before I started doing this, are there any questions? So far, so good. Everything is good. Okay, we can switch off the slides and so then models that we are going to talk about, which was one of the components that I listed, will be transition systems, and we will now see what those transition systems are. So, in the simplest version, a transition system is just a directed graph or a set with a single binary relation on it. Is this the notation that was used last year, by the way? Because I don't remember whether we were talking about W, R, or VS, where variations were kappas and pi's. So, this may be still adjusted. Then we will warn you if I need to make a switch to adjust to the script, but let's, or to the Hugh and Ryan book, right? Because we're trying to stay consistent with it. Anyway, so sometimes one is using W and R rather than V and S. So let's say that if we are going to compare two different transition systems, one of them will be written like this, another will be written like this. So, I assume that everybody here knows what Cartesian product of two sets are. Or in this case, actually, we are talking about V square, so Cartesian power of a set itself. It's the set of all the pairs, E, V prime, where both elements are coming from V. Everybody has seen this notation before? It's clear what it is, right? Okay. So visually, of course, we represent it as a directed graph, as I was saying. And one can, of course, say that this is a kind of structures. This kind of structures we have also seen in GLOLOP and GLOIN as models for ordinary first-order logic. And this is true. And the correspondence between those modal or temporal specification languages that we are going to deal with in the first month or so of this lecture and first order languages that we are talking about in GLOIN is going to be maybe not in this lecture, but quite often is very useful tool in research. But there are some important differences, starting from both in terms of results that one can prove about decidability of the language's expressive power, and in terms of perspective. So now we want to think of those structures not as if we were actually looking at them from outside and knowing always what's going to happen, but as if we were placed in a particular state of the process. And these are potential transitions that the process may take. And validity of every formula of our specification language will depend on the point in the structure that we are in. So in some cases it can be true that you can make one more step, and in some cases it may be not true. In some cases it might be true that all the passages or all the transition that you can make can continue forever, like here. In some cases, not. And you can go to a place where you encountering a deadlock, or you're getting stuck, or however you want to call it. And the very least that our system should be able to express is precisely this kind of features, possibly also a bit more. For example, being able to say that after each transition, this or that property will hold. But still, the kind of features that you can express in this language will be more stable or more robust than surviving under some straightforward transformation of the transition system than those that you can do in ordinary. You can express in ordinary first-order logic. One of the things that we most of the time want to assume would be that our systems are non-terminating, so you don't encounter a situation where you don't encounter a deadlock. Sometimes it can be already built in the definition of a model. Sometimes it has to be stated by means of a formula that has to be globally true. So let us design a very simple language to reason about this kind of properties and express this kind of properties. We have, let's say, a supply of predicate letters or unary prepositions. Again, I'm not sure how we were calling them last time, but let's say we call them prop P1, P2. And then, well, the very basic syntax that we have should cover at least all possible Boolean combinations of these guys. And probably you know how to use negation and conjunction to write all other possible Boolean formulas. Of course, I could also say that disjunction, or implication are primitives, and we will sometimes have the situation where we want to have only, let's say, conjunction or only disjunction, but no negation. But most of the time we want to work in a language where you have a possible Boolean combination. So far, so good. And the notion of a model that we have should simply be this kind of transition structure, sometimes also called Kripke frame. Maybe let's call it. Models are pairs consisting of transition structure or frame and evaluation. But the standard set theoretical convention is that this thing is the same as a triple. This last thing is simply evaluation, sending propositional variables to the power set of W, or V, or whichever of these letters we are going to choose. So far, so good. This is just ordinary propositional logic, and that you remember very well from Gloin and possibly also from other courses. And there is nothing in this language that corresponds somehow to the fact that we can make transitions between states. But just to reflect this local perspective, let us now express what it means for a formula to be true in a given, so let's write M, N for models. So let us write inductive definition what it means for a formula to be true in a given point or of a given model. When would this be true? Maybe if I'm talking about W rather than V, I should write this. Yes? Exactly. If, okay, maybe it's a bit more confusing. Maybe let's start with conjunction, sorry. This happens when? Yes? Exactly. So, satisfaction clause simply is translating linguistic or conjunction in the specification language into conjunction in the meta language, let's say. So similarly, the case for negation is that if it is not the case that phi holds at W, which is often written like this. And we can leave it as an exercise. I hope that you remember how Boolean definition of disjunction or implication look like to either take those additional connectives, disjunction implication, whatever else you want, Schaeffer's stroke, for example, as primitives, give the satisfaction clauses, and give the satisfaction clauses, and then use the standard definition that you see, for example, of GLOIN of those connectives, and show that what you get from this inductive definition of satisfaction corresponds to the standard satisfaction clauses that you would write. Okay, so far so good, but as I said, as things stand, this additional transition relation could be does not have to be there at all. There is nothing, so for timing we just have language to talk about elements of sets and their properties. So we would like to have some kind of logical operator or connective which allows us to say that something is true in, let's say, in the next state, or that something is true in all future states. Or maybe, if we also want to go forward and backward, also about the predecessor state or all past states. All those things are possible extensions of the language, and all of them can be added in a modular way, and most of them have even standard names. We will go through it within the next 2 or 3 weeks, actually a month, comparing possible extensions of the language. Let's begin with simplest one, presumably simplest one, I guess. So we let's begin with just one addition, saying that so a connective which allows us to check if at least one of immediate successors satisfies a given property. So this maybe let's keep then this language the way it is. Let's call it, I don't know, CPC for classical propositional calculus or whatever. And now our new set of formulas which will correspond will be called ML for modal logic, and we will keep all the ingredients that we used to have before. Conjunction before. And now I'm adding just one unary connective, diamond phi. And this is finally when we want to start using this additional accessibility relation. Anybody knows what the clause should be? Again, here the 4 or 5 people who have unfair advantage. You can make use of your unfair advantage now. So if for any, no, sorry, this is diamond, not box. If there exists W prime, such that W is related to W prime, and M W prime forces phi. So this is where you begin to see this dynamic perspective, where you are always standing in particular state of the model. An evaluation happens at a given state, and some of the connectives simply force you to make a step across the allowed transition, across the allowed transitions, and check if a formula is true in a successor state. It is, of course, a bit confusing whether this diamond should be transitive or not, and whether this relation itself is a transitive one or not. But let's just assume that it is not transitive, and when we are writing this ordinary diamond, we are talking about things accessible in one step. But in almost all the languages of practical importance that we are going to use here in this lecture, we will also have a connective which will be able to travel across the path. And actually, I'm already jumping ahead here a little bit, but this will be probably the most typical pattern that we are going to see, that we are going to look not just as points in the structure, but we are looking at all possible paths of development, and we are going to talk whether a formula is true on a given path or not when you forget about all the other points which are not on the path. And then you may be even in an expressive enough language to quantify over those paths. But this is getting a bit too quick for those, especially for those people who have not seen modal logic at all. So for the time being, this is the simple toy language that we have. And let's, before we start talking about the really interesting or important languages when you have path quantifiers and whatnot, let's think what kind of things can be expressed in this simple language. First of all, I wrote this definition with existential with an existential quantifier. Is there any way to say now that something should hold for all one-step successors if we have this language without extending it further? Yes? Exactly, of course. So let's define a connective box 5 as not diamond. And this is, of course, something that you have seen often. Even if you have not seen modal logic, you've seen this kind of trick with quantifiers. Let's say how you define existential quantifier using universal one, how you define universal quantifier using essential one, depending which connective you take as primitive. So, as an exercise, you can show now that MV box 5, if for all, sorry, I should stick to this W thing, for all W prime such that W is related to W prime, M W prime process. Right. Let's check if we have some non-trivial valid formulas, apart, of course, from those of classical propositional calculus. Actually, is everybody here familiar with classical propositional calculus? Maybe this is something that I should have established first, because I'm assuming that Boolean logic or CPC, I mean, you have seen it in this or that form, maybe even in high school when you're talking about Schaltkreis or whatever, and definitely those of you who had attended Gloin, who has attended Gloin, by the way, or Glolop, or however it was called. Glolop? Gloin?
Who has?
Okay, but there are still quite a few people who did not. So those who did not, were you mathematics, polytechnic? I remember that you are from mathematics, right? Okay, but then you're probably familiar with classical propositional logic and or Boolean calculus. Now it's a negative question. Who has not seen at all, in any way, any form, this calculus with no funny modality, is just propositional, ordinary propositional logic. Really? Okay. So you are not familiar, for example, with any decision procedure. How you don't know how to check whether a formula like this would be always valid, meaning that under every any possible valuation in every possible model, it will hold true. I'm not sure if actually I would need to think for a while if we rely on this knowledge anywhere in the lecture. Probably not, actually. But maybe it's a good moment to press brake pedal. And can anybody tell me how to check this? Because most of you have attended GLOIN, so maybe we can actually make sure that everybody is on the same footing. And spoiler alert, there are many methods. There is, it's not that I'm asking you about the one correct one. You can give me anything, but you know, you have to describe a proper algorithm. So forget for the time being about those boxes and diamonds, just this part. And if I write absolutely anything, like, I don't know, P and E or Q or P or Q implies R or, I don't know, P implies Q or R and pi and P and or whatever, any formula whatsoever, please describe a procedure, an algorithm, such that I'm able to say that there is a set, an evaluation in it, such that this, and a point in that set, such that this formula is valid, or it cannot be satisfied anywhere, at any point, any model, or dually, of course, if you prefer, describe a procedure to check that it has to be true under every evaluation, in every set, at any point. Is there an algorithm like this? Just by looking at the syntactic shape of formula, anything that you could propose. There is more than one of different flavors. Yes?
Just put past all values for the variables and evaluate the formula, the syntax tree.
Yeah. So this is, of course, probably involving some kind of blow up, right? So, for example, if we have this formula, how many evaluations I need to check?
Four.
In this case, how many evaluations I need to check? Yes, because I have three different variables. Each of them can be assigned true or false. Of course, most of the time, this can be sped up. So most of the time, it's pointless to look at all possible valuations. For example, we know that in order to reject a disjunction, you need to make both disjuncts false, right? So I know that I need to make this bottom, and I know that I need to make this bottom. But the only way in which I can make implication false is by making true, making the antecedent true and making the consequent false. In this case, I succeeded. But for example, I found a valuation refuting this formula. Well, now there is a bit of magic that we did not discuss. How, from knowing that there is a valuation refuting this formula, I can go to creating a model like this? But this is probably rather easy, right? It's, or maybe not. What should be the points of this model? And okay, this is something that we can postpone further. Maybe let's just finish discussing how this thing could also be used to show that a formula is always true. So let's say that instead I'm going to write P or P implies Q. Again, I know that in order to make this thing false, I need to make both disjunct false. But then, in order to make this thing false, I need to make this thing true and this thing false. And then it means that I have to have a valuation which sends this very same P to bottom and to top at the same time. And that was the only way of refuting this formula. So this does not work, so it means this is a tautology. So, still, in some cases, you need to check all possible evaluations. For example, in order to refute the conjunction is enough to refute one conjunct, so we need to check both options. But this is one way in which this truth table method can be made slightly smarter or quicker. And there are various other heuristics. So, and this is actually a huge business, finding as effective way of checking whether a formula is true or whether a formula of just ordinary propositional calculus is true or not. A lot of SMT and SAT solvers theory relies on it. There is even at least one famous algorithm which is patented. So you can still teach it in the classroom, but you cannot write a tool based on Stelmark's algorithm and actually earn money on this. But then you have to pay pay money to the mathematician who developed this algorithm of checking whether things that whether a formula of ordinary propositional logic is a tautology or not. But of course, this is much more complicated algorithm than this one. These things happen. At least if you want to sell, I guess this is programming in the United States. I'm not sure how it looks like in Europe, but I guess lawyers have their way of getting at it. Right. So this was a quick reminder on the issue of classical propositional calculus. Does anybody remember how computationally complex or expensive this was? To check if something is a tautology, or whether something is satisfiable, because you're talking about problem and its complement. Probably the only people who can sort of rely that, apart from those who attend a knuckle, but there are some people here who attend a knuckle, would be those who still attended Compalc, which was a very old course. But maybe some of you have heard about it anyway. So how complex it is to check in general whether a formula of calculus is satisfiable, so whether there exists evaluation which makes it true. Yes? No. Unless, of course, I mean, there may be all kinds of equalities that hold between complexity classes, but no, actually, no, this equality, no, this is not the default. This is precisely what you would get if you follow this brute force approach. And this is precisely why I'm saying that it is possible to be more refined. But actually, if you allow yourself to think, if you allow yourself to think about non-deterministic Turing machines, if you return to what was happening here, if you just allow yourself to guess the valuation for all the formula, for all the propositional variables involved, so you just throw a coin and you assign top and bottom, which may or may not be a good valuation. The only thing that you need to do then is to check if this valuation makes this formula satisfiable. And if at least one of these valuations that you obtain using this throw of a coin succeeds, then it means that your formula is satisfiable. And this is the kind of thing that is done by non-deterministic, but still polynomial Turing machines. So checking satisfiability of a formula is NP, and checking a formula is a tautology. If it's always valid under in every structure under every valuation at every point is a complement of this problem, so it's co-NP. And well, just this month there was some proof theories announced that they have proved that co-NP is equal to p-space, but this is still quite a revolutionary announcement, and I would not like to rely on this in this lecture. So let's assume that we are talking about different complexity classes here. So this is, in general, the best we can hope for when we are talking about languages which include propositional logic. And some of you may remember from GLOIN, I assume it is at least mentioned at GLOIN, that first order logic, where you have relation symbols, equalities, and quantifiers, is not exactly like this. Right? Who remembers whether first order logic is p space, validity is xp time, double xp time? Sorry? Okay, maybe we are talking about different problems. So this is something that one should be careful about when actually distinguishing between model checking and satisfiability problems. This is very, very different story. So I'm beginning to suspect that Some of you may be thinking now about model checking rather than satisfiability problem. Model checking problem is when you are already given a description of a finite model, you're given the interpretation of all the relation symbols, and you want to check if a given formula is valid in that model. This is very different type of problem. I mean, of course, this is very relevant for us here in this lecture. But for the time being, I'm talking about a general question whether without being given a model, like here, I'm not given any concrete valuation and concrete structure, you can decide if there should be some model, some valuation which make this formula true, or it has to be true generally in all possible models. And first order logic is not decidable. There is no algorithm. Unlike propositional logic, I just described to you some algorithms, and we could, of course, improve on this. We could also discuss some alternative related approaches like resolution and what not. Some of them are being discussed and growing. But for first order logic, these things just do not work. And if you want to look at validity on finite models, things get even worse. So soon we will start to talk about procedures of verifying whether a sentence holds in a given specific model, when we are given a concrete model with its description. But the question that I'm talking about right now is whether there would be some kind of language in between this ordinary propositional calculus and first order logic for which we would have decidable satisfiability problem. And of course, given that I already wrote one language on the blackboard, it might be that I'm already trying to nudge you in this specific direction. And it might be that this language is better also from the model checking point of view. When you are given a concrete finite model with and concrete algorithmic description of that model, it might be easier for this simple language, but also various languages extending it, to check whether a formula of this language is valid in that particular model than it would be when you describe that model using a first order formula. And this is where we are heading. So now that I have this overture on complexity out of the way, let's try to think again. Are there any interesting formulas in this extended language that are valid or not? Is there any chance that this language will be no more complex than the language of ordinary propositional logic? And if so, whether this can work just for model checking or also for satisfiability? Well, let's start with simple things. So, is it in general true that this formula will be true? Or to use a contrapose, this is a nice thing about Boolean syntax that you can always switch things around. Is this formula always true? Even those of you who have unfair advantage can use this advantage now. So if you have seen this kind of formulas. Yes? Why? What would be a good counterexample for that? Oh, sorry, actually this is the opposite. So let's actually talk about this formula too, but the one that I wanted to wrote is the dual one. But okay, why this formula is not true?
For example, you have the model in the state, in one state he holds, and in some following state it doesn't hold, so this formula is not true.
Yeah, so actually this formula can be refuted as soon as you have a state which is another state, right? So whenever you have a situation that X is related to Y and distinct from that Y, it's easy to define evaluation. Simply you make P true at X and false everywhere else, and then this whole formula will fail at X itself. How about this one? So this is for a trivial condition. As it's simply saying that as soon as you have non-trivial transition relation, non-degenerate transition system, as it were, this formula cannot be true. How about this one? The one that I wrote on the right. But is it for as trivial a reason as this one? Can you describe a counter model?
Yeah, for example, if we have one state where P doesn't hold, but it has successors where P holds, even if it doesn't have successors.
If it doesn't have any successor, including the fact that it's not its own successor. But you said that if it has successor where P does not hold. Well, okay. How about this guy? Can you make this formula false under some valuation in this point? So you have a successor distinct from X, but can you refute this formula here? Because from what you're saying, it would seem that it is as easy to refute this formula as it was to refute this formula. That the condition that you need is. Yes, so did you find a counterexample? Can you find a counterexample here in this structure?
No, but I need to find any structure.
Yes, so what would be the structure?
Simply one model with a simple only one word where P doesn't hold.
Is this what it affects here? Exactly. So the important point is that in order to be able to find the valuation refuting this model, it has to be reflexive. But there are, but if you think, for example, about a formula like this, this is actually very similar to, of course, bracketing, as usual in computer science, goes to the right. This is actually a direct analog of the law of distribution for universal quantifiers, right? So for all x, phi implies psi, implies that for all x phi, implies for all x psi. This looks good, right? Or maybe not. Maybe you can think of another example. Or something like this, which again has analog to the universal quantifiers, right? You distribute universal quantifiers over conjunction. Well, check for yourself. We actually, now it's not indecent to finish the lecture here. So I encourage you to check, we can call it bonus house of Gabber, but no points for that. If you want to check if this formula and for comparison, if this formula, for example, are valid. So we have a language where we can write some additional things which presumably can express or correspond to some properties of the transition relation of our models, which looks slightly, but only slightly more complicated than CPC, but definitely less complicated than first order logic. And we do have a strong hope that for this language, both satisfiability and model checking will look, even if we have to give up some of the complexity, low complexity of, well, depends what you mean by low complexity, decentish complexity of Boolean tautologies, it's still not going as dramatically bad as with first order logic. So this will be our starting point. In forthcoming lecture, we're going to discuss much more sophisticated languages together with model check, mostly model checking rather than satisfaction algorithms for them. And that gives you a teaser or a taste of how the first month or so of the lectures will look like. And then Christoph will take you on a quite different journey during tutorials. And as we agreed on Friday, we have installation session for a new SMB and new XMB. Any questions? Comments? Okay, so maybe we will need your, we are not going to have, even with this many students, a student web page. If not, then it would probably make sense to call email addresses of everyone, and if anything happens, if I post any material on the website, like slides or whatever, or we have announcement of yet another room change, we can send an email to people rather than have a mess like we had today. What is better, collect emails now by hand or create a student web page and use this? You are firmly against student. Who prefers student? Who is against student? This is a huge excluded middle. Okay, maybe just in case, create an email list. If you can quickly write your email addresses and pass it on to Christoph later on, and then I discuss with him whether it makes sense to create a student web page or not. Or is it better if they, if you collect email addresses during the tutorial session online? It doesn't matter, whatever. Okay, so bis nächste Woche dann. See you.